I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I saw a film today, oh boy.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movie.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles, and we're back. Well, I say we're back. Obviously, the last episode of our second season was only published earlier this week. So, in many ways, this special surprise bonus episode, from your perspective, is actually us just never going away. But we are back anyway to record a special episode. Why record a special bonus episode? I hear you shout on your morning walk. Well, the kind people at Disney Plus has granted us early access to watch their new film, If These Walls Could Sing, a documentary about Abbey Road Studios available to watch on Disney Plus from today, and directed by none other than Mary McCartney, daughter of Paul. It should also be said that this is the first Beatles Films podcast that Ed and I have just watched together for the first time, and we are recording this now as the credits roll. Well, not as the credits roll, always stated at the end of the credits, obviously. But the credits have just rolled, and we've sat elsewhere to now record a podcast. This is hot, fresh podcast content coming to you right now. I hope you're prepared. Ed, what did you think?
Well, just because we do it straight after, it means like we don't even have proper questions.
No, exactly. Like, yeah.
What did you reckon?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I liked it. Yeah.
This is hot off the press. First impressions?
First impressions. I think you... Here is the thing with documentaries in general. When you are interested in the subject matter, it is hard to dislike a documentary unless it's been done very badly. This has not been done very badly, but it's fair to say... It is sort of fairly nuts and bolts.
Yep.
I'm interested in the history of Abbey Road. I'm interested in lots of the musicians featured. Therefore, I found it interesting. I wouldn't say it's doing anything particularly special in terms of how the film is put together.
I think that's fair. I think the I said to you before we sat down and watched this that actually a 90-minute film of some famous musicians who I like and respect and enjoy hearing from, sharing enjoyable anecdotes about their time in Abbey Road, would be quite a fun, entertaining watch for me. I'd be quite happy with that. Having got broadly that, I think that it's clear that the film doesn't have an obvious narrative that is pushing.
Yeah.
A sort of an overview of the history of Abbey Road Studios, I guess is what it's trying to present.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite pull that off. I think it's a bit of a mixed bag in terms of bit of history, bit of fun anecdotes, a bit of trying to sell its audience on the importance of the studio, and I'd argue not necessarily succeeding in that area. But still, on the whole, lots to enjoy, and lots of really interesting facts that came out of this that I didn't realise, which we can get onto. Lots of stuff that I was actually quite, I think I might have even gasped at some point. So I don't know, you tell me.
You did gasp, yeah. You gasped more than once. It was embarrassing,
apparently. This is why you should never take me to the cinema. So just off straight off the bat, this is a film that is directed by Mary Courtney. She is in the film. She narrates some parts of the film, but I would argue not consistently enough for it to be effective in the way that I think it needs to be.
Yeah.
She also makes her presence known as the off-camera interviewer in a way that really brought me back to Wingspan when we covered that in that episode, especially when she's interviewing her dad.
Yeah.
And she's literally saying, my first memory of the studio is mum.
So there's
that Beatles connection. You know, how did this film get made? Well, it was made by Paul's daughter. But I guess given the obvious connection between studio and band, did you think that the level, the balance of Beatles content in this documentary about a studio that obviously has a history that extends far beyond just one band? Did you think that was well struck?
Well, it's hard to approach that objectively, really, given the title of this podcast, but I think that if you make a documentary about Abbey Road Studios, most of your audience is going to want Beatles stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that if you made a documentary about the Cavern Club, that's really why everyone's watching it, right? That obviously lots and lots of bands recorded at Abbey Road, lots of bands played at the Cavern Club, but they're iconic for a reason. I think maybe one of the problems with it is that when it's doing Beatles stuff, it goes right into it, and the anecdotes are they're mainly kind of ones that you've heard before. Not in all cases, but mainly it's stuff that you've heard before. But when it's in it, it's in it. Beatles stuff. It's sort of doing it properly. Then it does Beatles stuff for quite a while, then kind of stops and moves on to sort of Pink Floyd and Fela Kuti. It loses its luster a little bit. Maybe it doesn't lose its luster if you're a big Pink Floyd or Fela Kuti fan. But I kind of felt that. You feel like quite immersed in sort of Beatledom for a while, and then all of a sudden you're not in it anymore.
I think that's fair. I think the difference there is that I think it's, whether you're a Beatles fan or not, trying to stay objective here about the documentary, I think either way, I think it's quite clear that the sections on other artists are much more light touch than the Beatles segments.
Yeah.
So already you have a sort of apparent contrast in the documentary that I think presents a little bit of a problem for the film, because it just on the whole then that presents an idea of it being relatively uneven.
Yeah.
And there's no reason why that should be the case. I think that what the film is missing on the whole is a sort of a recognisable through line that focuses just on what the studio offered these artists.
Hmm.
What we have instead are sort of these introductions to the work that the artists did within the studio, and I guess surrounding context to that. But a lot of that isn't actually pertaining to Abbey Road Studios at all.
Yes.
A lot of it is just the history of the band or where the band were at that time. And,
and
I think that what we end up with is a documentary where I'm not quite sold on the studio itself being an important player in the output that came from it.
Yeah, it's not
to say that it wasn't, but I don't think the documentary presented that argument very well.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's not really making that point strongly enough. But also, you're not really sure whether it's trying to, particularly. There does seem slightly unfocused in the sense that it seems quite content just to give you what you want in terms of fairly low stakes, no great revelations, which is fair enough. Nice anecdotes about bands working there, and that's fine. But there is a point at which it does start to try and tell a story or introduce a bit of jeopardy is when it talks about the point in the late 70s, early 80s, when Studio One, the one that was sort of mainly, was designed for sort of orchestral performances and recordings, had sort of gone unused for quite a while, and the place was under financial threat because of this. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really explain why that was the case, you know, as if, you know, classical music suddenly no longer existed or something like that. Yeah. And therefore, you know, it could perhaps do a better job of saying this is why this was happening.
Yeah.
And then sort of says that when the sort of Lucasfilm for Indiana Jones and then for Star Wars it came in and recorded these big John Williams scores. John Williams is a really interesting talking head in it. And it's sort of telling the story of how that kind of saved that space and ultimately saved the studio financially. But what it doesn't do is it's sort of introducing that little bit of jeopardy, saying, oh, it all could have gone so badly. It all, you know, the place nearly went under, but now, you know, yeah, this saved it. And now then it went from strength to strength.
It doesn't have that savior moment. It just feels like it's going by numbers. It's like, yeah, oh, and then this other production company needed a space, so then it all worked out. It's not really, you're right, it doesn't give that sense of jeopardy, you're right.
No, it's not selling the actual peril, and it's not selling the idea that, you know, it's not selling how it was sold, you know. But as I say, like, it doesn't have to be, you know, dramatic like that necessarily, but it sort of lands between both, really, and isn't really quite doing both effectively enough, you know.
I think that's fair. I think that, you know, on a positive note, though, because it's, you know, it's an enjoyable film with, yeah, an enjoyable subject matter, I think on a positive note, what the film lacks in an overarching narrative, it makes up for in lots of, like, neat little quotes and moments that are just quite enjoyable to hear.
Yeah.
As soon as you said about the Studio One not being used, I immediately remember the technician saying that they laid down badminton lines and turned it into a court.
Yeah, yeah.
Just brilliant. Just like that's a 30, you know, what, half a second moment in the film, but just, yeah, there's lots and lots of little bits like that. And I was like, oh, that's quite fun. That's nice to know.
I actually, that guy who I think is called Lester. Yeah, Lester, I'm sorry, I forget his second name, but because we're sort of told in the film that the place has been staffed by the same people for years and years, and I have heard that before, actually, sort of artists saying, and Roger Waters says it actually, like, you know, they were recording Pink Floyd were recording their first album in 67, they went back in 69 to do Dark Side of the Moon, and the same people were still there. And I've heard people say that actually engineers tend to stick around for years and years and years. And that guy Lester was sort of introduced to him by saying to us, you know, people always say if you've got like some valve needs replacing or some part you need, go and see Lester. Lester's your man, you know. And then you see him, and he seems like he's an engaging guy, and he's sitting in this little sort of Aladdin's cave of all these little bits, you know, all these little bits of kit. And I thought, I would like to see a bit more of that.
Yeah,
I'd like to see, because, you know, there's real character in that, in the people who work there and the people who sort of keep it all going. He seems like a really good example of that, and maybe we could have seen a bit more of him, just to play up that character. You know?
I think what that, you know, the first thing I thought of, actually, now that you mention it, about introducing him was how does his role in the studio perform whilst studio technology itself is changing. So we are introduced to him, and he, you know, he brings out this piece of kit, and he says, this is I'm currently trying to repair a 60s microphone that somebody dropped.
Yeah.
And I just thought, how much call is there for a 60s microphone in Abbey Road Studios? Like, maybe a lot, I don't know. Yeah. But like, I don't think, you know, at the same time, presumably also the studio has had to keep up with the change in technology for recording sessions. And is there much call for 60s microphone when artists are presumably nowadays laying down sick hip hop beats, which is what they call them. I did some research.
Yeah, sure.
But do you know what I mean? Like, there are, you know, there's lots of differences in studio technology since that period. I guess what I didn't understand is the studio still sticking to older technology for purposes of integrity, or you know, maybe actual sound or sonar or quality purposes, Or is it just that's a side thing that Lester does, but actually the studio itself has evolved?
Yeah.
And actually, and that ties into another thing I was going to say to you, was that there is a point that is made at the end of the film where modern day artists, well, the film ends on this note of modern day artists like to record in Abbey Road Studio because of the history that it's steeped in.
Yeah.
And someone makes the point that it's almost like the studio itself is afraid to repaint the walls in case, you know, that changes the, you know, the magic that occurs in that room.
Yeah.
And literally the next sentence in that narration is about how the studio hasn't just survived over this course of period of time, but it's also evolved.
Yeah.
It's just like, so which is it? Like, yeah. is it stuck in its time because of the magical legacy it's had, or has it had to evolve over time? And if so, what way? I don't think I really got an answer to either of those questions.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Documentaries like this, I suppose, shouldn't leave you with questions.
No.
There's plenty of documentaries that do deliberately leave you with questions, and that's fair enough, but they tend to be more sort of like true crime things.
Yeah, exactly. Did he or didn't he?
Right, yeah. Right. Things like, you know, this child disappeared in 1981, you know, and, you know, what happened? We don't know. Less so, you know.
Yeah. There are no child disappearance questions here on the film, but there are other questions left unanswered.
Yeah. I think it's... The little ambiguities like that don't do it any favours, I think it's fair to say. Because, yeah, there's a bit where Noel Gallagher is sort of talking about when they went in and recorded Be Here Now in 96, 97, and you see this picture of him, a picture which I can remember seeing in The Enemy or something at the time, in Studio 2 on his own, and then it cuts to a picture of McCartney standing in more or less the same place.
Yeah, that's a great...
Where you can see the stairs behind them. In, I'm going to say, 64 or something like that. And you look at it and you think, oh, that room has barely changed at all. Like, it really looks the same. And also, like, I like the fact that when Kate Bush is talking about the video that they shot in Studio 2, and you look at the floor and, like, that's the identifiable bit, that sort of houndstooth pattern that they have on the floor, which has just been there forever, as far as you can see. And it's nice to see that the place, you know, retains that sort of continuity. But you're right, it's almost like it's, you know, it doesn't quite know what point it's making. This place is a monument to all the great things that have gone on there, and so, you know, it's sort of kept almost sacrosanct, but and yet, you know, it has to move forward with the times. It's not really it's not really saying which is which.
Yeah.
And it could do quite easily. It's not like these are difficult things to untangle, you know.
You know what, that's a really good point as well. The image edit between the Noel Gallagher pick and the Paul McCartney one is, I remember thinking, oh, that was a nice, neat thing that they did there. Hearing you say that makes me feel like there's a really easy way, if you wanted to, in this documentary, to powerfully depict how much good content and how much of a legacy the studio has. And that is to do more moments like that, to be able to match up. Doesn't have to be exact. I'm not saying, you know, like lay one image over the top of the other, but to be able to do that research and combine shots through the ages, where you can see, oh, this is this person standing in this room, and then 20 years later it's this person standing in the same room and it looks the same.
Yeah.
Like that's that would be quite a powerful way to communicate something about the studio's historical importance.
Yeah.
I'm in danger of saying this is what the film should have done, but but yeah, I think it just points to this idea that the film itself kind of lacks something like that to help make that point.
Yeah. I mean, there are a few ways in which it's sort of, you mentioned earlier the sort of half a voiceover that Mary McCartney does, you know, so she's sort of, it's introduced with her voiceover talking about, you know, her earliest memories, Paul and Linda in their recording, whatever album it was. Oh, there's footage of him playing 1985 on the piano, which is great. And I'd never seen before, actually, you know. So that's her voiceover kind of explaining, introducing the whole thing. And it kind of starts with an interview with Paul. Then it sort of goes off into more general talking head territory. Then a good, I'm going to say half an hour or so later, there's voiceover by her again. And you remember that she was narrating this. You thought, oh, okay, that's a strange... It's one of those... There's another film we were talking about where they'd done something halfway. What was the film we're only like 20 episodes in and I've already forgotten which films we're talking about. What was the one that had some reconstructions of scenes in a documentary, but only Eleanor Rigby and things, that used an actress to play Eleanor Rigby?
And yes, then, that would have been Sergeant Pepper's one, I believe.
Yeah. Sorry, anyway, yeah. So it's another... example of that thing where you make sort of half a narrative choice or half a stylistic choice rather. You don't really commit to it fully, so it just seems a bit jarring when it happens, you know.
I will also say as well that we'll talk about it later, but I think there's a lot of visual flair in this documentary that makes it interesting and exciting to watch, and as director I think credit for that goes to Mary McCartney.
Yeah.
So I think in her role as director, narrative issues aside, I think actually it's a nicely presented documentary. In her role as narrator, I think that grated on me a little bit. It felt to me like she was voicing over home videos, you know, rather than giving this subject matter... what it potentially needed was sort of a sense of more gravitas.
Yeah, and I think as you mentioned earlier, it sort of harked back to Wingspan a little bit.
Yeah.
Because it did remind me of that dynamic of... I suppose it must be incredibly difficult when you are the child of Paul McCartney and you want to make art of your own, to do so in a way where people, you know, can remove the fact that you are related to him from their judgment of it, you know. And certainly James McCartney, his son, you know, when he makes music, you know, he's quite prickly about this. You know, I can remember things like him walking out of interviews because they mentioned his dad too much.
Right.
And you can kind of see both sides of that.
You know what would help, though, I think, is being a director of films that aren't about Wings or the Abbey Road Studios.
Yeah, there's an argument. There's an argument to say that. It's a school of thought. I think it must be a very difficult creative space in which to work. However, you're absolutely right. This is the subject matter she's chosen. And I suppose, again, it sort of falls between two stools. That whole thing with Wingspan, where it seemed like quite an informal, nostalgic family project. And they were definitely enjoying the interview parts of it when they did those back in 2000, 2001, whatever it was. And again, there's a bit with, you can hear her off camera interviewing Paul. And you do hear a tiny bit in other interviews, but not much. It's mainly just, so I found that slightly jarring, whereby if it had all been interviews that are like quite informal and you hear her chatting to people as well as their responses, that would make sense. But it was kind of a bit of that with the Paul interviews and not there for the rest of them. So yeah.
I think just an add-on to that as well is right over the start of the credits. You see, we did stay until the credits. you have this moment right at the start of that where Mary McCartney is FaceTiming Elton John with her dad, right? And it's like, oh, look, you know, recognize this guy.
Yeah.
And all we get from that moment is Elton John being like, oh, all right, okay, see you later, mate. And that's it, right? Yeah. And it's like, what was that moment for? Like, unless it was to, because there's a nicer moment afterwards where Ringo Starr surprises John Williams.
Yeah.
And that's quite funny. I can't remember what he says now, but he says something very, very old and sort of
I can't remember either.
Quite stiff and be like, oh, fantastic, you know, or whatever it is. But the Elton John, and it feels like that moment has been included in the film to sort of break down the barrier to and show that Mary McCartney has like a familial connection to this place and the subject matter.
Yeah.
But actually that's not how the film has been approached. It's not been approached as Mary McCartney's and her relationship with the studios over time and what she thinks of it and stuff, and then that would justify her jumping in front of the camera and doing like a 5 second thing with Elton John and her dad on the phone.
Yeah,
doing that just kind of just introduces that for the sake of it, which is kind of I think something that the film is guilty of. I think it uses the Mary McCartney role in having the film made as a connector for the subject matter without really justifying it.
Yeah, because it can a project like this it must run the risk of being accused as a sort of celebrity puff piece kind of thing.
Yeah,
or you know she has access to an amazing array of talking heads, you know, and I suppose it's and by the way, it's completely reasonable to make that film. But again, she sort of makes half that film and half a more straight ahead documentary. You know, it doesn't necessarily do itself any favors with those more sort of celebi moments. You know, like that bit. But I mean, you know, this is one thing. A bit like, you know, a lot of films will have sort of outtakes across the credits, that kind of thing. I suppose it's doing the same thing as that. So you know. Wouldn't be, you know, I don't think we're being too harsh on it, but
sounds like it, doesn't it?
it does a bit, yeah.
Right, let's go on to some more positives then, because like I said before about some of the visual style in the films, I like that a lot of it is presented in this sort of artificial, I always call it Super 8, it's not always just Super 8, but this sort of, you know, square 1x1 formatted footage in the center of the screen.
Yeah.
I think always showing like the rough edges of that footage, you know, like the cigarette burns, the end of reel stuff that sort of is edited between the archive footage.
Yeah,
it uses. I think all of that stuff does actually look really nice and neat and helps add like a sense of unique style to the documentary in a way that a lot of documentaries that we've covered in this podcast don't have that. It's very much a straight archive footage and talking heads elsewhere.
Yeah.
This actually at least is presenting that sort of historical content within its own unique style.
Yeah. I think it can be like too easy just to present these things straightforwardly. There are bits where we've talked when we've talked about other documentaries, we have talked about archive footage and montage, especially when you only have a still image, what do you do with it? You know, so you know that thing that we've come back to before about, you know, if you're doing a serial killer documentary, get the police mugshot and then slowly focus in on their eyes. Yep. You know, that'll take up a good 15 seconds.
You really
seconds.
Do watch a lot of true crime, don't you? This is we're like what, half an hour in. This is a second reference to true crime documentaries.
Yeah, that's fine.
No, it's fine. It's okay. Go for it. As long as we've got like a benchmark by which to judge all Beatles related documentaries, that's fine.
But no, I think what it does is it will take a still image and then not just sort of zoom in on it slowly, but there's a sort of 3D effect to the way it's being manipulated. There was something similar in Ron Howard's 8 Days a Week documentary, where especially there were kind of still images, but sort of there'd be things like cigarette smoke was animated and things like that. I don't remember that. So it's quite similar. You know, there's a shot of George Martin sort of up in the control room studio too, and over his shoulder the band can be seen, and it's just a really well-framed image. And it takes that image while there's a voiceover going over it, and just sort of moves in while his shoulder is kind of moving slightly.
Like this depth perception effect, isn't it? Where yes. You kind of can see the, you know, it feels like a really image.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of the footage of Fela Kuti. There is the still images of him are dealt with by presenters sort of superimposing on the screen what look like the sort of negatives of the images and things like that. You know, and so as you were saying, it's sort of using that thing of the actual nuts and bolts of the imagery, you know. And I thought that was good. It had a visual style of its own, certainly. When it would have been, I shouldn't imagine anyone was calling for this to have a visual style of its own. And I think like Mary McCartney deserves credit for that, certainly, because it would have been very easy just not to bother with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think this might be controversial to say, but I think that my understanding would be that as director, Mary McCartney would agree and approve that kind of approach, but the actual doing of it or the idea of it probably comes from an artistic director or designer working on the film. And actually, you saying nuts and bolts make me realize that the reason for all of that obviously is because this is a film about the behind the scenes of work that we all know and love. This is the studio where it all happens, so actually it makes sense that the footage is presented in a way as if it were showing the behind the scenes and literally the nuts and bolts of, you know, of that medium each time. You know, it's kind of like a neat little sort of almost subliminal connection there about us seeing behind the curtain a little bit, shining a little bit of light on the magic of how that's been created.
Yeah, definitely.
Were you, like me, very, very impressed with exactly how much actual footage exists of bands performing in Abbey Road Studios from that time period? Because I was like, well, when it first started, I was like, well, I feel like I've seen some footage, particularly the Sgt. Pepper sessions, but there can't be too much. But there was loads, like footage of the Pink Floyd's recordings as well, for Dark Side of the Moon and all that stuff. I was quite impressed that it even exists. Like, who was filming at that point in those sessions, you know, like to what end was there cameras rolling on a lot of these sessions?
Right.
I just didn't realize a lot of it existed. I mean, maybe it's just really obviously it does, because, you know, at this point the work and the artists themselves are important enough for that to happen, but
yeah,
I just wasn't expecting that level of you know, actual footage from that period.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the thing is, like, this is only all this sort of Beatles footage we're getting. A lot of it is around the time, or at least only 2 or 3 years on from when they're doing interviews to people who are asking them, how long do you think it'll last? And they say, well, probably 3 or 4 years, that kind of thing. Because nobody has it. There is no template for a pop band lasting at all. It just didn't happen. It's not what they were for. And yet, only a couple of years on, they're all in Studio 2 recording an orchestra for A Day in the Life, and someone thinks, oh, I should film this. This is going to be significant, you know. And then, you know, Pink Floyd are in there recording, as you say, Dark Side of the Moon, and someone says, this is significant enough to film. And so it just seems like maybe culturally, like, it's come quite a long way, the thinking of the significance of pop bands, you know, just to the point of is this a waste of film? You know, is anyone going to be interested in this in a year, let alone 50 years?
That makes sense. If anything, it also highlights that footage of the Beatles recording the White Album and actual Abbey Road in that studio doesn't exist, presumably, because it's not present in this film and we've never seen it. I guess there's the footage of Blackbird.
Yeah,
but is that all to your knowledge?
There's a little bit where it says it's Hey Jude rehearsal footage, which it says is Studio 2, but I think that is Trident Studios. Certainly, Hey Jude was recorded in Trident Studios. I don't know whether they it's on YouTube. There's a video that's about 20 minutes long of Hey Jude sort of run throughs, recording sessions, and I think it's the same room as that. So I think that's probably from Trident. But anyway, yeah, that's that footage is there.
Yeah. Interesting. But I guess to your point, you know, Also, I think for the White Album, I guess there are reasons why there wasn't probably a huge amount of footage that was shot at that time during those sessions, because of the band not necessarily perhaps wanting that to be around, or the circumstances of the recording of those sessions. Certainly when it comes to Abbey Road, I can understand why they don't want a camera like within 50 yards of the front entrance. So but yeah, it's not surprising, but also I guess a little bit of shame in the context of this documentary, where you almost, it's particularly around Abbey Road, you almost would like to see more content about the band recording the album that gives it its reputation.
Yeah, yeah. So actually, I mean, the pictures you always see of those tend to be just the ones of Paul and George. And it looks like they're probably recording "Here Comes the Sun," which John wasn't involved in because he was off after he and Yoko had the car crash in Scotland. He was off recuperating after that, so he missed some of those sessions. But yeah, so you see a few of those. Yeah, I mean, as regards the White Album, like one nice bit in it is there's a nice continuity between Ringo talking about recording Your Blues, because he says the same thing in Anthology, which, you know, and so he, and so we're very close to 30 years now since he recorded those Anthology interviews. And he's still talking about how much he enjoyed recording Your Blues, because they went and recorded it in a little kind of storage room, like no separation, you know, just to get away from that overdubbing thing, which is a really nice story. And he's really enthusiastic about it. Ringo's really funny throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, yes, he is.
But then they do, when he is telling that story about Your Blues, they have... what seems to be footage of the actual storage room where they recorded it. And it, if that is what it's doing, it's not kind of, it's not making the point that it is that storage room. And it's not giving you a sense of how small it is. Ringo says it's, you know, no bigger than this carpet, you know, and sort of points out the size of the carpet. But then if they are showing you the actual storage room, it's not really giving you a sense of that, you know. And I think it's just, you know, they're not sort of missed tricks necessarily, all of these things, but I do think that there is the odd thing in here where you just think, oh, that could have been tightened up a little bit without much effort, really.
Yeah, like, yeah, I see what you mean. We mentioned earlier that there are some moments in the film that literally made me gasp more than once. Just like neat little facts that I didn't know before, that I think, if you know, if your fandom revolves around certain artists, you'd probably be already be aware of. But I had no idea that Jimmy Page played guitar on Goldfinger.
No.
I didn't even know that Elton John played on He Ain't Heavy as My Brother.
I did. You know what? I was aware that Elton John was a session piano player. And I read his autobiography last year as well, which I can thoroughly recommend. And yeah, he played a lot of whether he played specifically on that song, but there are quite a few songs around that period where his piano playing is like song, I can't remember them now, but like songs that you would absolutely recognize.
Yeah, yeah.
They're like,
yeah,
quite, yeah, well known.
Oh, that's interesting. I have to check that out. But I think I think it goes to show that some of the talking heads in this are used very, very well, because they really are talking about their relationship with the studio,
yeah,
and not just I was in the band when we recorded this thing at the studio. So I think some of that works through. I think that Jimmy Page in particular seems quite in awe of the place in his time as a session musician,
yeah, there,
which is quite nice to see. You mentioned earlier as well, the way that John Williams talks about how sound works within the Abbey Road studio is quite amazing to hear. Like the phrases he uses in my mind have no place in describing music at all.
They have no place in a sentence.
But he talks about the way the music blooms and has a face on it, yes, I think at one point as well, which is just fantastic.
Yeah,
and he's John Williams, so you can't question it. Like, he clearly just gets music more than us.
Well, you know what, that's exactly what I thought. Yeah, you think, oh, this guy just really sort of feels music in a way that we can't quite appreciate. And one of those things where someone is using words to describe things, and the words don't quite fit, but you do get what he means by it, you know, just through the context of it.
Because
you know?
He's talking about it so sort of aspirationally, like it's just, it's just, it's said with such enthusiasm and awe, which is nice to see.
Yeah.
I also really appreciated some deliberate, I think, deliberately, I want to use the word facetious editing between the Gallagher brothers. Because... Yeah. Yeah. So we are introduced to Noel, first of all, and quite early on in the documentary. And what he says is something along the lines of, it is going to be some kid's dream to walk into here and be able to play music in here in the way that his heroes have done. And that dream can't die. It just can't. Mm. It can't die. It immediately cuts to Liam Gallagher, who's looking over his shoulder and is like, yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it? It's just fantastic.
Yeah.
And then later on, there's this almost like the talking about how they were apparently thrown out of Abbey Road Studios for smashing stuff up. Mm. And Noel says that that's what happened, and it immediately cuts to Liam saying, well, there were some rumors that we smashed the stuff, but that didn't happen.
Yeah.
And it's almost like the film has found a way to make the Gallagher brothers squabble without even being in the same room.
Yeah, yeah. And but also the nice thing about the way it's edited is like they're both in being shot in the same room at different times, but they are sitting in such a way as they could be. There are points when like, Noel makes a point and then he might look off to his right and then it cuts to Liam, who is like looking to his left, as if looking straight at Noel.
I'm so glad you noticed that. And I picked up on that.
It is very deliberate editing. It's very funny as well.
Definitely.
Because I mean, that thing at the start where Liam just says something completely off the cuff and then you don't see him again for a good half an hour or whatever. And you think, if that's everything from Liam Gallagher, that is very funny indeed. But actually, what I will say is that, so, I mean, the thing with Noel and Liam is like, I mean, Noel is like an excellent raconteur and he's very witty. Liam is obviously a bit more of a loose cannon in terms of interviews, you know. But what I did, I thought there was a bit like quite near the end where Liam, unlike a lot of the Talking Heads, like really nailed something about how the place itself was special, which, as we've said, it was. The film wasn't necessarily focused on all the time. It wasn't, you know, sort of making that point very clearly all the time. And he talks about when they were recording their last album, which would have been in sort of mid-noughties. He says a thing about, you know, I'd get up early and come in because you can't just sort of be on the end of a phone and only come in when you're needed. You need to get in and soak it up, and you think, he says, let it seep into your veins.
Yes, well, that's right, yeah.
Which is really nice, and I got the impression that like this guy really understands this place, and it means something to him. You know, it's easy to forget that guy is he is much more switched on, and he is much more sort of emotionally literate than people give him credit for.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Yeah, yeah. He is more eloquent in this film than I've seen him in most interviews. And by the same token, you mentioned Noel's normally a very witty raconteur in interviews.
Yeah,
there isn't much of that here either. It's only very much talking about, you know, Abbey Road Studios with respect, you know, and giving that respect to the place. That's quite interesting. Another talking head that I think we have to touch on, Giles Martin, who doesn't necessarily offer much in this film that we haven't heard him say in other, or even where he's just repeating what George Martin has said in other documentaries and interviews. But he does seem to have access to very clearly isolated tracks from very, very early Beatles album recordings.
Suspiciously so.
Yes, exactly, yes. Yeah. You have to wonder. Like, this is, you know, this is what's been happening, all anybody has been saying, particularly since Get Back film was released, is whether or not the same technology can be applied to those early albums and we can expect remastering of those.
Mm.
This feels like the first indicator where Giles Martin himself is actually at the control desk proving that that is possible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Twist and Shout. He's you know, he's...
Oh, was it Twist and Shout? There was a couple, wasn't there? But yeah, that
turning
was...
Turning bits of it up and down.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know what, like, you see so many sort of music documentaries, you think of things like VH1 Classic Albums in particular, where like a real trope of those of those shows is that there'll always be the producer like sitting at the massive mixing desk talking about the thing and then mixing, you know, sort of fading something up so you just hear the isolated vocal or whatever, that yeah. kind of thing. And like it happens so much that I almost get, and actually if you think about McCartney 3-2-1, where Rick Rubin is kind of doing that. And I think it's almost as if these documentaries sort of need a driver in a sense, i.e. a guy who is literally at the sort of technical controls, pushing buttons and throwing levers and just like showing you how everything works.
Yeah.
It almost helps you to drive through the whole thing. Because, yeah, I mean, I agree, like Giles is not saying much that we don't already know.
Yes.
Which is fine.
It's fine, yeah, like, for this kind of, this level of documentary, it's fine.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think on the whole, I know we've sort of over-egged this point possibly already, but I do think that I guess I'm left feeling as though I don't fully appreciate how the studio itself deserves credit for the output that came from it.
Yeah.
There are moments, you mentioned, Liam talking about seeping the atmosphere into his veins. There's a really couple of nice moments from Paul where he makes some insightful remarks about the studio in a brilliant moment that's going to happen in any Paul McCartney interview where he's surrounded by musical instruments. He looks behind him at one point and says, "Oh, there's the piano that I was just talking about." Immediately gets up and plays Lady Madonna.
Yeah.
But he makes the point that, but there was a, I think he said it was a Lowry piano, I think he said. But he makes the point that there's the piano that he played, or the instrument that he played at the start of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Yep.
Then he goes on to talk about the piano that he then plays Lady Madonna on, and about, I always think of it having a bit of a honky-tonk
It's the Mrs. sound. Mills piano. Yeah,
Mrs.
Yeah.
Mills piano, yeah. Yes, thank you. And then you see him sat at a Steinway and playing something more refined. And he follows up on that by saying that because there was such an eclectic range of musical instruments available in the studio, that's what led Sgt. Pepper to have such an interesting sound, because they were able to utilize lots of different sounds within the room itself, which I thought that was possibly the single best moment in the film that really summed up for me why a space like this, used in the way that it is, actually leads to great work.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's a point that is pushed hard enough in the rest of the film.
Yeah.
He even says, for example, that the climactic orchestral climax at the end of Day in the Life was possible because that studio was able to have an orchestra of that size in that space performing that.
Yeah.
And that, I think that helps bring the value of Abbey Road Studios to life more.
Yeah.
And it just needed a little bit more of that, I think, in the film.
Yeah. That is a really good point. And when it does make it, you think, oh yeah, that makes sense to me. But it isn't doing enough of that, because you'll then get another sort of 10 minutes or so of it sort of very interesting sort of anecdotes from musicians, but they're not picking up this sort of narrative through line and running with it. You know, it's not making its case where it's supposed to make its case, I suppose.
And I think we've probably come full circle here with the point you made, first of all, when I very insightfully asked you, what do you think?
Yeah.
In that there are reasons to pick out flaws, I think, in the documentary. But on the whole, the subject matter, you know, it is very enjoyable to sit through and watch for 90 minutes just because of the content it presents.
Yeah.
But hopefully you agree at home. And if not, or if so, feel free to contact us and message us and let us know. As always, you can reach us on all the usual social media platforms. We are at Beatles Films Pod on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Please feel free to get in touch. And I hope you've enjoyed this special one-off extra bonus episode to help wrap up season 2. Please feel free to give us a follow on all those platforms as well. And you'll be hopefully first to find out when we'll be returning for a new season 3. But until then, thanks for listening and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.